Contrary to what was widely believed, largely through misrepresentation by the countries themselves, the Geneva Conference did not produce a plan to settle the comparative problems of Indochina. It did arrange for the defeated French to disengage with a minimum amount of loss of prestige, considering their circumstances. It did help the USSR scuttle the then-fledgling EDC, or European Defense Command. Stop. That's the end of the tape, right? And then I turned it over and activated. It's supposed to stop when I stop talking. It should be more than 45 minutes. Yeah, six lectures and I still haven't gotten it right. Anyway, what the conference did allow is the French to get out. It allowed, under fairly good circumstances, it gave the Soviet Union an opportunity to scuttle the EDC, or European Defense Community, which was a fledgling NATO. This was in a bilateral deal under the table between the French and the Soviets. And it enabled the Chinese to advertise their then current foreign policy, a coexistence policy, the sort of spirit of Bandung, it was called, coming out of the Bandung Conference, in which China was trying to assure its neighbors on the periphery they did not have to worry about Chinese hegemonism and suzerainty claims and so on. But the conference produced nothing to guide the newly emerged Indo-Chinese states into their uncertain future. It offered a few banal platitudes, but at no point did it ever come to grips with the problems that existed within Indochina, political problems. France was at Geneva for essentially one purpose: to get out of Indochina with the least possible embarrassment or appeasement of capitulation. Its bargaining chip was removal of the French Expeditionary Force. It was a kind of dog in the manger. Even in defeat, as long as the French Foreign Legion and the other troops remained in Indochina, they could block Viet Minh political plans. The Viet Minh were in Geneva for one purpose: to arrange to become the rulers of all Vietnam, theirs by right of military victory. What they had to offer in negotiations were face-saving measures for the French, for French withdrawal, and perhaps certain promises of future favorable arrangements for France and Indochina, economic promises. For French interest was primarily military, and the Viet Minh interest was primarily political. Now, the Viet Minh conference strategy, agenda strategy, at the beginning of the conference, was to insist that the various political issues be solved first. That is, a political settlement be reached before a military ceasefire was arranged. Now, the Soviet and the Chinese delegates, for their own motives, various reasons, persuaded the Viet Minh to drop this strategy and to accept or agree to discuss ceasefire, separation of contending forces, withdrawal of the French army, in short, military matters, simultaneously with considering future governing arrangements in Vietnam and throughout Indochina, as the staging of elections and kind of political decision-making, all political matters. It was that basic tactical error, you can call it an error, by the Viet Minh. Actually, it was a sellout by the Chinese and the Soviets. Both of them had been dealing separately and secretly with France in pursuit of their own interests. It was outright collusion, really, by China and the USSR against the Vietnamese. We didn't know this at the time. We only found out about it much later. And we got it from the horse's mouth. We got it from Nikita Khrushchev. The book Khrushchev Remembers. Let me read, this is a little long, but it's so good. Let me read. This is Nikita Khrushchev, General Secretary of the Soviet, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, writing in his memoir. I met with Ho Chi Minh many times, Khrushchev said. I remember our work together during the Geneva Conference in 1954. At that time, we still had good relations with the Communist Party of China. Before the Geneva Conference, there was a preparatory meeting in Moscow. China was represented by Chou Enlai, and Vietnam by President Ho Chi Minh and Prime Minister Phan Van Dong. We worked out a position that we would take in Geneva, basing it on the situation in Vietnam. The situation was very grave. The resistance movement in Vietnam was on the brink of collapse. The partisans were counting on the Geneva Conference to produce a ceasefire agreement that would enable them to hold on to the conquest they had won in the struggle of the Vietnamese people against French occupation. Hanoi was securely in the hands of the French. If you looked at a map, which our own demands for a settlement were marked out, you'd see North Vietnam was pockmarked with enclaves which had been captured and occupied by the French. After one of these sessions in Catherine Hall in the Kremlin, Chou Enlai buttonholed me and took me into a corner. He said, "Comrade Ho Chi Minh has told me that the situation in Vietnam is hopeless, and that if we don't obtain a ceasefire soon, the Vietnamese won't be able to hold out against the French. Therefore, they've decided to retreat to the China border, and they want China to be ready to move troops into Vietnam as we did into Korea. In other words, the Vietnamese want us to help them drive out the French. This is the Chinese speaking on it. We simply can't grant Comrade Ho Chi Minh's request. We've already lost too many men in Korea. The war cost us dearly, and we're in no condition to get involved in another war at this time." This is Khrushchev now speaking. I made a request of my own to Comrade Chou Enlai. "An important struggle is going on," I said, "and the Vietnamese are putting up a good fight. The French are taking heavy losses. There's no reason why you should tell Ho Chi Minh that you will refuse to help him if his troops retreat to the border under the French blows. Why don't you just tell him a little white lie? Let the Vietnamese believe that you will help them if necessary, and this will be a source of inspiration for the Vietnamese partisans to resist the French." So Chou Enlai agreed not to tell Ho Chi Minh that China wouldn't come into the war against the French on Vietnamese territory. You don't usually find this kind of candid acknowledgement of what a son of a bitch you were in politics. It's sort of refreshing, particularly the communist side. But it was the milieu I don't think Ho Chi Minh was all that naive. I think he understood exactly what was going on. No other explanation really as to why he agreed to go along with this when he had actually won the ball game. Anyway, the net effect of this duplicity was to nullify and circumvent Hanoi's bargaining position, just cut the ground right out from under them. The ceasefire was arranged and the military issue was settled. The moment it was achieved, French purpose had been served. France had gotten what it came to the conference to get, all that it could hope to get. So it grew indifferent to the yet unsettled matter of the future of Vietnam political arrangements. In a narrow sense, I suppose you can say this was understandable. Paris obviously had little incentive to use its influence to the benefit of the Viet Minh, which they'd been fighting for in the last 8 years. In a broader sense, however, it really was irresponsibility personified. France had been in Indochina for 70 years. It had benefited materially. When the time came for Indochina's transition from colonialism to self-government, there was no French tutelage. As, for example, we have seen elsewhere. They simply washed their hands of the matter and left. For its part, the Viet Minh was left without a bargaining power at the conference. Having granted France what it wanted, a military ceasefire, it had nothing more to trade. Why was the Viet Minh betrayed by its allies? On Moscow's part, it is generally believed that it was because of this deal that they cut with the French. the USSR would support the French in whatever they wanted at Geneva, provided they would scuttle EDC. And de Gaulle did subsequently kill the idea of French participation. Although we don't get the kind of candid statements out of Paris that we got out of Moscow in this way. So you can't ever, there were these two events. Were they linked or weren't they? Most people, if you're suspicious and cynical, say yes, they were. But you can't really prove it historically. China, I think, pressured Hanoi because it was trying to pursue this so-called peace line in Vietnam. It suited their purposes, though I don't think the Chinese really cared all that much. Now, two documents came out of the conference. One dealing with the French and military affairs was called Agreement on Cessation of Hostilities in Vietnam. It was very explicit, very detailed. It dealt with the technicalities of the ceasefire, the separation of the contending forces, how you get them off the battlefield and into sort of enclaves where they can be disarmed, and then the French part can leave. The second document was called Final Declaration of the Geneva Conference on the Problems of Restoring Peace to Indochina, usually called for short the Final Declaration. It was not a legal document, nor it was neither in precise legal nor diplomatic language. Hence, it is vague and unclear in key paragraphs, probably deliberately so. It was not signed by anyone, and it was denounced even as it was being issued by the South Vietnamese government, which had refused to attend the conference in the first place. Your final statement, if you treat it as a kind of expression of political need in China, was totally unrealistic. As a guide to future political action, it was irrelevant. The best it could offer was to call for elections, but it was not ever indicated anywhere of what these elections were to be or what they were to be for. Were they to be elections to elect a constituent assembly that would write a new constitution? Was it to be an election in which would be a referendum? You'd have a chance to choose between Ho Chi Minh and Bao Dai or Ngo Dinh Diem. Was it to be a plebiscite on unification or partition of Vietnam? It simply said that elections should be held. Actually, to make it even worse, it did not endorse the idea of elections as a means of settling political issues. Rather, it said that the political issues should be settled, and then you have elections. Well, that's what an election is for, basically, is to settle political issues. Article 19. Let me read this to you. In order to ensure that sufficient progress in the restoration of peace has been made, and that the necessary conditions obtained for free expression of national will, general election should be held July 1956. To ensure that progress has been made in the restoration of peace, you hold elections to ensure that the necessary conditions obtained for free expression of national will, you hold elections. That's what an election is, an expression of national will. So it's a tautological. Well, read that many times later and in many conferences and lectures. The subject came up. I reached the point where I had memorized this thing. I'd read it from Article 19. And then in about 1965, I think it was, I was at the French embassy reception, a garden party in Saigon, and wandering around with a drink in my hand, and I encountered this Frenchman, and we started talking, and lo and behold, he said, you know, I was at Paris, or I was at Geneva in 54. I was one of the team, French team, that helped write the final declaration. I said, really? Maybe you can explain something to me. Article 19, and I rattled it off as I did. I said, I have read that once, I have read it 100 times, and the more I read it, the more involuted it appears to me, the more confused it means, the more unsure I am as to what the hell you people meant by that. And it is long, and he grabs my hand and he shakes it like this and he says, "Ah, now what a compliment, Monsieur, what a compliment. You know we were up all night writing that thing and rewriting, and this is exactly what we wanted, something that nobody would be sure what it meant, and nobody could say this is wrong because you don't have it." But it is an exercise in political science. Just get a copy and read it. And the more you read it, the more you can see how cleverly it promises, you know, elections, free expression of national will, progress and restoration of peace. But then it's all upside down, and the more you read it, it doesn't say anything at all. It's just a bunch of words. Well, the point is, on that sentence, and backed by that, nothing else really in the Geneva Accords, for there is nothing else, two giant and enduring historical fictions have been erected. The first is, and you still encounter this from time to time, is that the Geneva Conference in 1954 set down a political blueprint for peace and harmony in Vietnam that would have succeeded had it not been sabotaged by John Foster Dulles and Ngo Dinh Diem. The second, which plagued us throughout the war, was that the documents that came out of the conference were a realistic basis for ending the Vietnam War. That is, quote, implementing the accords could be the way, the solution, the formula for ending the Vietnam War. Well, neither Dulles nor Diem did not sabotage the accords, because there really was nothing there to sabotage. Just there was not then or later anything to implement. The conference ended in a kind of shock of failure that the Viet Minh delegates, they still tended to leave, the ones that were there, I think, tended to leave with a hope that somehow, through the instrument of French diplomacy, political process would be pressed and somehow a new governing structure would be arranged for Indochina, at least for Vietnam. The people back in Hanoi, and there was quite a sharp division here within the Viet Minh over, there were Viet Minh who were against going to Paris or to Geneva at all and argued against it. And there's some old-line journalists, Dennis Warner, the Australian, Bob Chaplin, the American, who were in Hanoi at the time in 54, and were talking to Trung Chin and some of the hardline Hanoi figures who were going around Hanoi utterly denouncing the Geneva Conference before it even got started, really, and were saying that this is going to be a disaster in Geneva and we should have no part of it. And I think the point is that though that Ho Chi Minh was directly involved in this, and he was able to sort of convey a prestige to even to the failure that nobody could sort of openly criticize, or, and I'm sure he was able to rationalize it. The basic argument he made was that this is an interim arrangement. We didn't come out so well at Paris, but. We still are going to get all of Indochina. Probably the Russians and the Chinese use the same argument. You have got nobody really in Indochina that can stand up to you. This guy Ho Chi Minh, this guy Bao Dai or Ngo Dinh Diem are nothing really. They don't have the organization. They don't have the moxie. They don't. So South Vietnam is going to fall, collapse of its own weight. Therefore, you're going to get it in the end. And you're going to get it by being a nice guy. This was not an unrealistic estimate. I think a lot of Americans thought the same thing. Ngo Dinh Diem did not have a prayer of a chance. That's why it became the Diem miracle when he did succeed. If he didn't do it, I didn't think he could do it. So if he did do it, it had to be a miracle that he did do it. Only way you can explain it. Anyway, their hopes were kept alive for a while, and there was a considerable doctrinal debate in Hanoi as to how to proceed with the objective of unification. But from the Geneva Conference to about 1959, when the decision was taken to begin armed struggle, DRV, the North Vietnamese strategy, was to achieve their objective unification with single Vietnam through the instrument of French diplomacy, hoping that the French, one way or another, would, quote, implement the Geneva Accords and bring this about. The French, I don't think, could do this, and there was no real reason why they should. Anyway, it didn't happen. I think it gradually became clear in the Politburo in Hanoi that the time itself, with the so-called Zim miracle, was cheating them out of the fruits of victory. And this grew into a kind of cancer, I think. Victimized by fate, they had been betrayed by their friends. There was a kind of immense moral outrage that came out of this that forged a determined resolve that they were going to have what was their rightful heritage. Spirit, I think, that drove them into the Vietnam War and drove them into the way they pursued the Vietnam War. All right, let me say just a bit now about the Viet Minh War and the Cold War and the post-World War II period from a foreign perspective, from a Washington, from the view of Washington policymakers, and to the extent we have time from that, from the Chinese and the Soviet policymakers. I don't think I'll be able to get to this much. This, in effect, what I'm dealing with here really is the meaning of the post-war events to the Americans based on their perception of what was going down at the time. Generally, the view was that, and even later looking back, was that the genesis of the Vietnam War that ultimately developed lay in the conditions and the immediate events which flowed out of World War II. That's what fixed the history on the course that it did. Now, the essential strategic situation in the region, the whole Southeast Asian region, as of August 15th, 1945, the day that World War II ended, as seen from Washington, was an Asia which was already vastly altered by war, was about to be buffeted by a force of flux and change, the direction and magnitude of which no one could chart with certainty. Japan lay in ruins, the dream of her Asian hegemony smashed, her psyche numbed, her future uncertain. The USSR, of great strategic potential power at that moment, was only that, a potential. America, so recently aroused from the comfort of isolationism, stood alone as the dominant force in the Pacific, a position assured by a monopoly of nuclear weapons, a giant undamaged industrial plant, a huge navy and air force, and a victorious battle-tested 15 million man armed force. No other force in Asia was of any strategic importance. Now that assessment is correct only in sort of 19th century geopolitical terms, in which strategic advantage is measured by these relatively narrow military and industrial strength, natural resources, technological capability, and so on. Strategic advantage was soon to be redefined in Asia. Nationalism, which is a lesser force of lesser importance in traditional estimates of strategic advantage, was on the march throughout Asia, and it was to prove decisive. Colonialism was ending under the relentless pressure of self-determination throughout Asia. the French, for their own reasons, decided to, again, this is the perception of the Americans at the time, French had decided to confront nationalism and to fight for Indochina. That made the Viet Minh War inevitable. Although it was disastrous for the French, the Viet Minh War ended indecisively as far as Indochina was concerned, and that indecisiveness is what made the Vietnam War inevitable. American strategic interests in Vietnam, Indochina, Southeast Asia, after World War II were minimal. Certainly when you set them against U.S. interests in Western Europe and the vital task there of reconstruction. And France was crucial in this within Western Europe. So American policies were of necessity conditioned by the need for harmonious relations with the French. When American leaders were obliged, as they occasionally were, to choose between serving American interests in Indochina or serving them in France and Europe, the choice was not regarded as a particularly difficult one. Our people, Chaplin in his The Lost Revolution, has the thesis that we should indeed have backed Ho Chi Minh and not backed the French in the Vietnam War. The history would have gone in the opposite direction. Maybe this will be history's ultimate judgment, but it was simply a politically impossible position to take at the time. During the Viet Minh War, there arose early in Washington a difference of opinion as to whether the Viet Minh did represent totalitarian aggression, and therefore whether the Munich syndrome, as we've talked about, was applicable. There was, I think, though, no difference of opinion that geopolitically you cannot replace something with nothing. So there was a strong consensus that the strategic vacuum, that a strategic and political vacuum in Indochina was not in American interest. Hence the need for American policies to prevent disequilibrium or national disintegration, regardless of what happened to the French. We hoped, I think, originally that the French would hold the line here, but later it was evident that, I think it was a feeling that the French should hold the line and prevent this disequilibrium, but they could not do it by military means. Therefore, what the expectation was and the hope is, and I think the advice to the extent we gave it, was that the French should seek some kind of an accommodation, like the British did. But American estimates of French prospects, I think, were always, from the very early days, on the pessimistic side. There was very little faith in these overly modest French diplomatic proposals, French Union, for example, and certainly much less faith even in the Indochinese French Expeditionary Corps. But in actual practice, I think it's true that the U.S. generally went along with whatever it was the French sought to do in Indochina. They considered this their acquiescence, if you want to call that, the price to pay for ensuring success in the Marshall Plan in Europe. Now, in the opinion of some, such as Chaplin, this policy sacrificed essential American national interests in Asia without actually enhancing its policies in Europe at all. His argument is the French were in the Marshall Plan, they would have stuck in the Marshall Plan. It was saving them economically, so they couldn't go any other direction without it. So what we really should have done is turn the screws on them and their Indochina policy. As the only time we ever really said no to the French was at Dien Bien Phu, in which they asked us to intervene with air power, even to consider using nuclear weapons. We told them, I think, up front that nuclear weapons are out. Eisenhower was the man in charge of this, and what he really did was to use a political gambit. He said to the French, yes, well, we would be considered going in, but it would have to be a combined operation. We'd have to get the British in and probably some other people. So that's the way we want it done, if we're going to do it at all.